Side 3, Pearls of Lutra by Brian Jakes. Continuing on page 100. Tansy could not resist a little joke. If tears are the answer you need, go no further than Viola Bankvo. She's always weeping and whining about something or other. Let's try her. Martin gave the hedgehog maid a sideways glance. Probably because she's easy to pick on. I'm surprised at you, Tansy, making fun of the misfortune of others. The regret Tansy showed at her ill-chosen remark was sincere. I'm sorry, sir. I'll try to be kinder to Viola in the future. Rollo patted her paw cheerily.
Well spoken, young'un. That's the true Red Wall spirit. Here, finish this pasty off before it grows cold.
Tansy needed no second bidding. Teasel's pasty was delicious. For a long while, the three friends sat in silence, staring at the thin scrap of parchment and pondering its meaning. Cavern Hole was peaceful and warm, and soon Rollo's glasses started to slip further down his nose as his head began to slump forward. Martin winked at Tansy and nodded towards the drowsing old recorder. Then he blew gently on Rollo's eyelids. The bank vole blinked several times and sat up straight, as if he had never dozed off, saying,
Ahem. Right, where are we? Still studying this rhyme, eh?
Martin kept a straight face as he replied,
Aye, still studying. Have you come up with any good ideas?
Rollo's paw shot up decisively.
I've got it. Here's what we must do next.
Martin and Tansy exclaimed together.
What?
A twinkle shone in Rollo's tired old eyes.
Go straight to bed, before we all fall asleep here and wake up with stiff necks and rickety backs. Now don't start pouting, miss. We've got to sleep sometime.
Tell her, Martin.
The warrior mouse rose and stretched.
He's right, Tansy. You'll see, a clear morning after a sound night's sleep and a good breakfast always improves a creature's brain power. You'd best sleep in the dormitory. Viola is in your infirmary bed. Come on now, up you go.
Despite her protestations that she was not the least bit tired, Tansy found the dormitory bed soft and comfortable. Sleep stole up, gently closing her eyelids and leading her into the realm of odd dreams. Martin appeared, but he was not quite like the Martin she knew so well, and he was wearing a magnificent suit of armor. Tansy realized that this was the other Martin, the warrior founder of Redwall, the same mouse whose likeness was woven into the tapestry which hung in Great Hall. He wore the same sword she had often seen the present Martin wearing. Tansy felt happy in the presence of the warrior. He radiated strength, safety, and confidence, and his voice was soothing when he spoke.
Maid of Red Wall, search, and never give up hope. You will find joy, frustration, and sorrow in your quest. Never forget that friendship and loyalty are more precious than riches. Remember these words on the day you must return the tears to their true owner. Happiness can be brief, but it knows no time in the land of dreams. Sleep on, and I will show you.
The warrior's image faded, and Tansy went deep into the most pleasant dream. Like a leaf she was borne upward, and she wandered with the breeze through quiet summer woodlands, resting in sunlit coppices, drifting on margins of still water meadows, and dancing lightly over faraway flower-clad hills. 14. Friar Higgle's stump was up and about early the next morning. He trundled down to his beloved kitchens, grumbling to himself,
I wager breakfast ain't but half started yet. Best be about my business, hungry mouths to feed. That sister Cicely, she'd have a body lying abed all season for no good reason. Us stumps are made of stern spike. 'Tis plain no seagull can bother me.
He strode boldly into the kitchens, only to be met by his wife Teasel's accusing eye.
I knowed there weren't nothing wrong with you, Eagle. I expect it was you sneaked down last night late and took a slice of that parsnip and mushroom pasty I left out to cool afore I went to bed.
The good friar brushed past her stiffly, saying, Shame on you for even thinking such a thing about me, Marm. When did I ever filch food from me own kitchens, eh?
He set about measuring oatmeal and barley into a mixing bowl before livening up the oven fires with fresh charcoal. Teasel took a tray of nut bread rolls down from her cooling shelf, her muttering blending with that of Higgle. Both hedgehogs chunnered to themselves as they went about their cooking chores.
A pasty that eats itself? Ain't naught but mysteries of late in this ere abbey. Mysteries and mischief. Huh. This honey's stiff as glue. I'd best leave it atop the oven to warm through. Parsnips don't agree with me. Why should I want to eat a pasty? We're going to need more white cheese afore the morning's done, aye. And this oven fire needs a good raking out.
Abbot Durrell had also risen early. He strode into the kitchens, rubbing his paws in a lively fashion.
Good morrow to you both. Can I lend a paw? Here, that fire needs raking out, Teasel. Let me do it.
The three friends went about their work as the atmosphere lightened and mouth-watering aromas began pervading the air. Durrell helped Higgle to carry a small churn of green-sap milk from the cooling slab to the mixing bowl, explaining his day's plans as they measured it into the oatmeal and barley.
I thought I'd take a stroll into Mossflower Woodlands today, collect some coltsfoot and brooklime, maybe find a clearing where some red clover is showing. It's going to be a nice warm day. I feel we'll soon have a hint of summer.
Friar Higgle winked knowingly at his friend and said, Who knows? Mayhaps I'll be able to make you some pastilles, if'n you collects enough those plants, Father Abbot.
Durrell hid a smile, putting on a mock defensive tone.
Coltsfoot pastilles are good for the young ones. Keep them fit. Good for coughs and any number of small ailments.
Teasel had been eavesdropping on the conversation, and now she tapped the abbot's paw lightly with her ladle.
I don't suppose it'd have anything to do with a certain abbot of Redwall who likes to carry a little bag of coltsfoot pastilles to suck. Some elders are worse than dibbins, I say.
Durrell lifted the warmed honey from the oven top, protecting his paws with a cloth.
You would say right, Teasel. I've been dreaming lately of having a good pocketful of nice sweet coltsfoot pastilles.
During breakfast, the abbot called Tansy to his side and whispered in the hogmaid's ear,
I'm off into Mossflower today, collecting plants. How do you like to come with me? It will be mild and sunny. We could take lunch with us. What do you say?
Much to his surprise, Tansy refused the offer.
Thank you very much, Father Abbot, but maybe you'd like to give someone else a chance. Take poor Viola Bankbowl with you.
The kindly old mouse was pleased, but perplexed.
Certainly, Missy. But why Viola?
Because I feel sorry for her, and I think we should be friends. Last night Viola had bad dreams, so I put her in my bed at the sick bay. I thought I was helping her, but Sister Cicely came in during the night and made her drink a big bowl of warm nettle broth. Poor Viola. She's sitting over there unable to touch any breakfast. See, she looks a funny color to me.
Abbot Durrell looked up from his mint tea.
You're quite right, Tansy. A walk in the woodlands and a picnic lunch will do your friend a power of good, I think. But what will you do with yourself all day?
Tansy's voice dropped to a secretive whisper.
I've got business with Martin and Rollo. We've a riddle to solve. Very important.
The glorious spring morning rolled on into early noontide, with Redwall Abbey abuzz as creatures went about their chores and young ones played across the lawns.
Skipper of Otters and his stalwarts patrolled the ramparts, striding along the high battlemented outer wall, ever alert for the slightest sign of invading gulls. At the woodland's edge on the north path,
A mass of cow parsley with white flowering buds stirred, which was odd because there was not the slightest breeze to move it. The corsair ferret, Romska, popped her head up momentarily before dropping back out of sight. "Last time I saw that place I was with Captain Conva, and we was on the trail of old Greylunk. That's Redwall Abbey, right enough."
Despite the warmth of spring sunshine, Lask Frildor was still shivering from a cold night spent wandering through the damp woodlands. He was not in the best of tempers.
"Why not raise your voice a bit louder, so they can hear you properly, Addlebrain?"
he snarled, drawing a heavy cloak tight about his quaking body. Romska leaned towards him, her voice contemptuous.
"Button your lips, slop-tongue. I'll talk when and how I like, see? Huh, it don't matter if they ears us. The moment those abbey creatures catches sight of you, they'll be dumbstruck for sure."
Lask loosened the cloak and puffed out his throat airily.
"You speak nonsense, fool."
Romska snorted as if in despairing amusement.
"Listen to him, messmates. Every time he opens that gob, he treads on his tongue.
Let me tell you something, Monitor.
A fact you and the Emperor overlooked. Them abbey beasts can't abide sea rats, corsairs, and such like. So imagine how they'll take to the sight of you and 10 other reptiles. Great flesh-eaten lizards from the tropics beyond the sunset.
Aha! Never thought of that, did you?
They ain't never seen the likes of you before.
What do you think they're going to do, invite your inside for cakes and wine? Cha! They'll slam the gates tight in your face, give those monitors a volley of spears, and send a lot of you packing up the road, just like any right-minded creature would. I'll take me oath on that, matey.
Deflated, the monitor general drew away with his 10 remaining monitors and went deeper into the woodland, where they could hold a conference. Romska had left a guard of 6 vermin aboard Waveworm, but her corsairs were still 3 times the number of Lask's force. They too drew back into the wood, but only to light a small fire on which they could cook their supplies, supplemented by whatever roots and fruits they had foraged from the countryside. Rubby the cook held out a young turnip he had spitted and roasted on his cutlass blade. Romska accepted it and lounged nonchalantly in the sunlight. Ragflan the bosun joined her, munching a stalk of wild celery.
"So, what are you going to do now, Captain?"
he said. Romska spat out a tough piece of turnip.
"Do? I ain't doing nothing, matey. Old Scalegutz is in charge of the land party. Let Lask do all the doing."
Ragflan cast a glance through the bushes.
"Ahoy! Here comes old Lask himself. Looks like he wants to talk."
The monitor general dismissed Ragflan with a nod and seated himself next to Romska, saying,
"Perhaps what you say is right, my friend."
Romska flung the half-eaten turnip away and wiped her mouth.
"Oho, friend, is it? You've changed your tune, lizard.
So tell me, what's the plan?" Abbot Durrell sat on the bank of a small stream with Viola Bankrull. They ate nut bread rolls and cheese, washed down with sips of old cider, for lunch. The father abbot kicked off his sandals and lowered his footpaws gingerly into the cold, clear water with a long sigh.
"Ah, that is truly delightful. Nothing like stream water for refreshing the footpaws. You should try it, Viola."
The bankroll maid stared doubtfully at the gurgling stream.
"But I don't like getting my footpaws wet, Father, and besides there's no towels to dry them."
Durrell smiled benevolently at the prissy little creature.
"Grass, soft moss, or dead ferns are as good as any towel, Viola. Come on, you'll never know what it's like until you try it."
Slipping off her sandals, the vole maid lowered her footpaws into the water. She shuddered, then giggled.
"Hee-hee-hee! It tickles, and it's cold. But you're right, Father. It does feel good. I think I'll stand up and have a paddle."
Lussac and Fraddle, two of Lask Frildor's monitors, had been unsuccessfully trying to catch birds with a net. Finding the stream, the two lizards had followed its course, searching for a likely spot where fish might be found. Fraddle suddenly held up a heavily scaled claw, saying,
"Hearken, listen. I hear voices."
Crouching low, they wriggled silently forward. From behind a screen of hemlock and dropwort, they watched two creatures clad in green habits, an old mouse and a young bank bull, prancing in the stream shallows, laughing and splashing. Lussac's dark tongue snaked out hungrily.
"Food at last," he breathed.
Fraddle's claw shot out as Lussac started to creep forward. Seizing him tight by the loose jaw flesh, he dragged until it threatened to tear.
"No, these will be prisoners for General Lask."
Viola and the abbot sat on the stream bank, rubbing their footpaws in the sun-warmed grass.
"Oh, Father Abbot, what fun! You were right when you said that."
"Eek!"
The tough twine meshes of a ship's net trapped them both. They were pulled backward and hauled up the bank. Terrified, wordless, and stiff with fright, the old mouse and the young bank bull found themselves staring into the foul-breathed faces of two reptiles they could not have imagined in their worst nightmares.
"Be still, or be slain."
15. Apart from a few helpers, the kitchens were quiet after lunch had been served. Martin and Rollo sat on grain sacks with Tansy, questioning her closely.
"Are you sure you can remember no more of your dream, Tansy?"
"I wish I could, Rollo. Really, I do. I can remember seeing Martin the Warrior of ancient times, and he said many things to me, though it all seemed so fuzzy this morning. It was something about searching and never giving up hope. Then more words about friendship and loyalty. Oh, and he mentioned about one day giving the tears back to their true owner. I'm sorry, but today my mind doesn't seem to be working properly. Oh, dear, it makes me so irritable when I can't remember exactly what he said."
Martin said understandingly,
"No matter, Tansy. All will become crystal clear when our warrior's spirit wishes it so. The main thing at this moment is to solve the riddle. Would you read it again, please, miss?"
Tansy unfolded the flimsy parchment scrap.
"I think the relevant part is in these last four lines. Listen. Go find my gift, good friar. This tear is given free, not hid away in secret, but there for all to see."
Rollo donned his glasses and stared at the rhyme, saying,
"Firmold meant this for Friar Higgle, really. Don't you think we should go to him and ask for his help?"
At that instant, Formol and Higgle emerged from the wine cellar ramp, rolling a small cask of elderberry wine between them. Formol unbent and grunted,
"Yours, or Higgle. Us'll take it o'er to e corner thar."
Rollo called over from his perch on the grain sacks,
"Friar Higgle, can you spare us a moment, please?"
Leaving Formol to trundle the cask, Higgle came over, his homely face wreathed in a big smile.
"Phew! We none of us are as spry as we used to be, friends. Good job I got Formol to help me. Now, what can I do to help you?"
Skipper of Otters was a big, tough-looking beast. He turned on the wall top as one of his otter crew called across from the south ramparts.
"Nary a sign of gulls again today, Skip."
Skipper's deep, gruff voice rang back in reply.
"Keep your eyes peeled, though, Glenner. We'll give it another day or two yet. Mayhaps they're watching us from afar."
As he took his eyes away from the cloudless blue noon sky, Skipper saw a ferret emerge from the woodland fringe. Everything about her, from the brass ear hoops to the tattooed paw and ragged silks she wore, branded her as sea vermin. She waved in a cheery fashion at the big otter.
"Ahoy there, Ruddertail! Is this the place they call Redwall?"
Skipper became immediately alert.
"What if it is, Snipe Nose? What's your business here?"
Oh, just some information. No need to get offended.
Skipper chuckled, amazed at the ferret's impudence.
Bless your eye, matey. I'm not offended at a corsair calling me Ruddertail. Though if and I was down there now, I'd give you such a clout you'd land up in the middle of next season.
Romska laughed back, giving as good as she got.
You're a big saucy beast. Talk it all brave from up there. Why not come down here and try your luck, river dog?
Skipper wagged a hefty gnarled paw at her.
My old mother never raised no fools, corsair. Where's your sword and daggers? Lying in the undergrowth with the rest of your slimy crew? Now say your say and begone, quick and sharpish.
The hogwife Teasel arrived up on the wall top, carrying a basket.
Good afternoon, Mr. Skipper. I brought up a snack for you and your crew.
Who's that creature down there? Skipper peered into the basket, his face lighting up in appreciation.
Nothing to worry your good head about, marm. Thank you for the victuals, though.
Beg your pardon, whilst I deal with this villain. Immediately the skipper of otters became serious, whirling his sling until the thongs hummed.
Say your piece, scum, or stand by to eat stone.
Romska spoke out smartly.
Where's Greylunk? I wants ter speak with him. You're wasting your time. There ain't no Greylunk here.
Ah, come on. You can do better than that. Either bring the weasel out or return what he stole.
Skipper and his crew were infrequent abbey dwellers, living mainly in Mossflower's woodlands and waters, and he had no idea what Romska was talking about, and he was not a beast to stand arguing.
Quack!
The slingstone bounced off a sycamore trunk a hair's breadth from the corsair's skull.
Next one goes down your throat, vermin. Now clear off!
Romska leapt behind the sycamore trunk, shouting,
We know you've got Greylunk in there, and the pearls. It'd be a lot easier on you if you brought 'em out.
Hogwife Teasel popped her head over the battlements and cried,
Greylunk left ere seasons ago. They found his remains not 2 nights back in the woodland rocks. The red ones east of here. Greylunk's dead long ago, so be off with you.
So you say. I'll be back again at this time tomorrow, Romska yelled.
When it was obvious Romska had gone, Skipper chided Teasel gently.
You should have told that and nothing, marm. I'd advise you to find Martin and tell him all that happened.
Back in the kitchens, Friar Higgle had been shown the rhyme and told all about the situation. He shrugged.
Alas, I know nothing about any gift. Old Firmald never gave me nothing but smiles. I wish I could help you, but I can't. A tear for all to see? That's a real poser, friends. I must start baking for supper now. You'll have to excuse me, but good luck to you.
Feeling defeated, the three wandered about the kitchens on a futile search. Then Klecky ambled in, followed by Garrow. The mountain hare looked about hungrily.
I say, chaps, is it nearly tea time? I'm famished. Sorry, are you looking for eatables too, what?
Rollo walked around Klecky, investigating the shelves behind him.
No, we're not, you great famine fetcher. We're looking for a tear that is in plain view.
Garrow blinked several times, shifting from one talon to another.
Ah, well now, if me good friend Klecky here doesn't get something to devour soon, no doubt you'll see plenty of tears in plain view, sirs, and you too, miss. Old Klecky here can blubber up a storm if the food isn't forthcoming. Indeed he can.
Tansy fidgeted with her apron restlessly.
Oh, bother! How can you hide something, and yet leave it in plain view? It doesn't make sense.
Friar Higgle looked up from the rhubarb crumble he was making.
Aye, especially when you don't know what it is you look for.
Klecky knew what he was looking for. The hungry hare had spotted a box of candied chestnuts on a far corner shelf. He sidled slowly over and tried to snatch some of the delicious sweets. Unfortunately, there was a huge, ornate wooden candlestick standing between Klecky and the shelf.
The immense candle it held was lit only once every four seasons at the first summer feast. Wax had melted upon wax over the seasons, crusting the top of the carved holder. Klecki stood with his back against the candle, trying to appear as though he were doing nothing. However, behind him, his paws were working furiously. With one paw around each side of the candlestick, he grappled and grabbed furiously, trying to reach the box standing on the shelf behind the giant candle. As Tansy and her friends wandered about searching, Friar Higgle became alerted by the scrabbling noises. He looked directly at Klecki.
"What are you doing over there, sir?"
The hare stood with both paws searching madly behind his back for the box as he tried to stand still, smiling casually.
"What? Who? Me?
Old feller, nothing at all. Nice and snug in this corner, don't you think? What?" The friar advanced on him, shaking a ladle threateningly.
"You're up to some prank, I know it. Now get out of my kitchen. Tea'll be ready when I've made it."
He grabbed hold of Klecki's tunic and pulled sharply. "Come on, out, I said." But the hare had hold of the box in both paws and was unwilling to let go. He tottered forward and overbalanced, shouting indignantly,
"I say, let go, you great foozlin' friar! Yaha!"
Higgle dodged to one side as the hare fell, bringing the candlestick crashing down to the floor with him. Candied chestnuts from the fractured box rolled around the kitchen floor stones. Martin and Higgle helped Klecki up. The friar was furious.
"Now look at what you'd done, and all through sheer greed for a few chestnuts. The great summer candle is broke, snapped clean in two pieces. You'll pay for this, Sir Ten Bellies."
Rollo, Tansy, and Garrel were gathering up the spilled nuts. Tansy could not help grinning as she nudged the old recorder.
"Rollo, shame on you. Don't eat them. Put them back in the box. Really, a bowl of your seasons, pinching candied chestnuts like a dibbon. You're worse than Klecki. Hello, what's this?"
By accident, she had trodden on a lump of the congealed candle wax, which had broken from the holder in its fall. As the candle wax broke under Tansy's paw, a large pink globe rolled out across the floor. Martin stared at it in wonder.
"A pearl," he whispered. "A perfect pink pearl."
"So that was it," said Rollo, "hidden in plain view. Firmald pushed the pearl into the molten wax, and it set around it. Clever." Rollo sat flat upon the floor, watching Tansy breaking up the rest of the hardened wax globules.
"Tears. The tears of all oceans. We're hunting for pearls. Why didn't I think of it before? The most precious thing to come out of the great waters, though I've never heard them referred to as tears of oceans before. What a charming description. Tansy, you're making a dreadful mess breaking up all that wax over the floor. What are you doing?"
The young hedgehog maid produced a greasy ball of rolled-up paper, the same size as the pearl, from among the wax pieces.
"Ha! I found it! The clue to the second pearl!" she cried.
Klecki tried to look as if he was not chewing three chestnuts as he swaggered about, dusting himself down.
"Humph! Snch! Knew I'd be able to help you, chaps. Glub. Takes an eagle eye and a sharp brain to hunt the jolly old pearls, you know. Gromph! Snch! No need to thank me. All in a day's work, what? Youch!"
Friar Higgle's ladle caught him smartly on the tail, and he fled from the kitchens, yelling amid the laughter that followed him.
"Base ingratitude! Yowp! Desist, sir, I say. Ouch!"
16. Of all the sea-going vermin frequenting San Petra, Rasconza was the only fox. He was bosun to Slashback, sea-rat captain of the ship Bloodkeel. Rasconza was tough, ambitious, and smart. After the captain's revolt, he had appointed himself leader of the rebel crews roaming the island's high hills. The fox was a renowned blade-thrower,
having about him no fewer than 10 daggers, which he would use at the drop of a paw. None of the other vermin challenged his position. Rasconza crouched on a hilltop at the isle's northwest tip. Behind him, in a hollow, the vermin crews lay about, eating fruit, roasting fish, and dozing in the warm tropical noon. But the fox was alert, watching the sea before him. Baranka and the captains were sailing the freebooter towards the inlet below, unaware that Sagatar, with a full crew of trident rats, was following in the blood keel. Baranka had taken the open sea route, but Sagatar had followed at a distance, hugging the coast. Bloodkeel was now lying in wait around the high curving hills of the headland. Once Baranka sailed his ship into the inlet, Sagatar could slip around and block the exit with her vessel, trapping Freebooter and the captains. It would be the perfect ambush. Rasconza's sharp brain and keen eyes took in the situation at a glance, and he laid his plans swiftly. Slipping away from the drowsing rebels was but the work of a moment. Once out of their sight, the fox dashed headlong down the cliff towards the inlet, and arrived in time to hail Baranka as Freebooter nosed into the shallows.
"Captain, 'tis I, Rasconza. There's a shipload of trident rats lying in wait for you. They'll round the point soon and trap you."
Baranka glanced around the narrow inlet, realizing it was too late to backwater, and turned for an open run out to sea.
"We'll have to stand and fight 'em. Are the crews close by, mate? We're going to need help."
Rasconza put on his steadfast and honest face and saluted Baranka.
"Leave it to me, Captain," he said, voice grim and determined. "I'll muster 'em and get back here in a flash. You hold those trident rats off. I won't be long."
Baranka returned the salute as Rasconza trotted off.
"That's the spirit, messmate. Together we'll give 'em a drubbin' they won't forget."
Rasconza ran puffing and panting uphill until the ships below looked like toys. Slowing down, he crept into the hollow where the crews lay asleep around the ashes of their fires. The fox cocked up both ears and listened, satisfied that he could hear no noise from far below. Then, retrieving half a roasted fish from the paws of a sleeping sea rat, he began eating slowly, mentally calculating the weight before putting the next stage of his plan into action. After what he deemed an appropriate interval, Rasconza stood up, kicking those about him into wakefulness.
"Our captains are being massacred down there. Look!" he yelled.
He dashed to the hilltop and pointed down to the inlet. Wave vermin, rubbing sleep from their eyes, joined him, yelling outrage at the scene below.
"Trident rats! They've got the cove blocked off! Scum, they've overrun the freebooter! Let's get down there and rip into 'em! Aye, we'll make the waters run red to save our captains!"
Rasconza strode to the fore, bellowing.
"Too late to save those captains now, mates. I got a plan. Listen. We split into three groups. Baltur, you take one lot down there to the left, bypass the trident rats, and board the bloodkeel from her stern. Gancho, you take another lot to the right, and board her from the forward end. That way we've got ourselves a ship. I'll take the rest straight down the center and attack the trident rats. I'll make 'em pay for slaughtering our captains."
A roar of approval went up from the crew beasts. Sagatar had not thought it would be so hard to slay six captains and take one prisoner, but it had been a long and bitter fight. Once she had blocked the inlet by anchoring Bloodkeel across it, she ordered her trident rats to attack. They went overboard and had to swim until the water was shallow enough for them to wade. The captains were waiting for them. Having armed themselves with pikes and boat hooks, they dashed around Freebooter's rails, hacking and stabbing at every head that appeared over the side. But numbers began to tell. Urged on by Sagatar, the trident rats fought their way aboard. Immediately Baranka and his companions abandoned ship, and, wading ashore, they speared viciously at the foe beasts in the shallows. Then Flaney fell to a trident thrust, followed by Ripdog and Rockpaw. Back to back, Slashback, Bloodsnout, and Bilgetail kept off the advancing trident rats. Baranka joined them, blood streaming from him as he slashed about with his saber, shouting,
Where's that fox got to with our crews?
There was nothing left but to turn and run. Bilge Tail and Bloodsnout went down, pierced by tridents. Slashback staggered on uphill, mortally wounded, Baranka supporting him. Finally, Slashback fell sideways, knocking Baranka over as he did. Surrounded by trident rats, Slashback breathed his last words into the Corsair Stoat's face.
What happened? Where's Fox?
Baranka was dragged upright roughly.
So, Corsair, Sagatar sneered at him, I told you that you'd have me to deal with, but you were too clever to heed my words. How do you feel now, scum?
Baranka laughed harshly at his captor.
You're lily-livered, cur. You should have been within reach of my blade, instead of leading your army from behind.
Sagatar ignored the jibe. She turned to her trident rats and ordered,
Scuttle the freebooter in the shallows. Her sailing days are over. The rest of you get aboard Bloodkeel and prepare to get underway.
Scarcely had the trident rats opened freebooter's seacocks when a mighty yell arose from the rebel crews, who had succeeded in boarding the Bloodkeel. Sagatar wheeled in dismay to see Baltur and Gancho and hordes of wave vermin at the rails, yelling and roaring.
Come on, buckos, make crab meat of 'em.
Ha-ha! Give 'em steel and take no prisoners!
Stranded on the shore with a mere 10 rats to guard herself and control the captured Baranka, Sagatar's last shred of courage deserted her at the sound of more blood-curdling yells from behind. She turned and saw Rascanza leading a pack of vermin downhill, straight at her. The Emperor's chief trident rat fled the scene, dashing off southward at a tangent into the hills. Baranka whooped triumphantly, and breaking free of his guards, he ran with open paws towards Rascanza.
Ho, ho, you're a sight for sore eyes, matey, he cried.
As the corsairs threw themselves upon the 10 trident rats, the fox grabbed Baranka in a tight embrace.
Aye, Captain, your worries are over now,
Rascanza said, as, smiling slyly, he slew Baranka with a single knife thrust. Then, sheathing his blade quickly, he cried out,
They slew Captain Baranka, the scum! Finish him off, buckos! I'll get Sagatar if it takes me last breath!
He sped off after the chief trident rat. Sagatar threw a fleeting glance over her shoulder. The fox was hot on her trail. Stumbling and panting, the trident rat gained the hill summit and staggered southward, hoping to reach safety at the Palace of Ublaz. Rascanza pursued her relentlessly, grinning as he closed in on his quarry. Sagatar's paws felt leaden. She blew for breath as she started downhill. Chancing another quick look behind, she tripped and went rolling head over tail down the grassy slope. Rascanza bounded lightly alongside the trident rat until she came to rest, half in and half out of a gurgling stream. Helpless and unarmed, Sagatar lay with the fox's knife at her throat, expecting no pity from him. Rascanza flicked his blade point teasingly under her chin.
Well now, me beauty, what's to be done with you?
Sagatar broke into a sobbing whine.
Mercy, spare me!
Standing upright, the fox kicked the trident rat contemptuously.
Quit your sniveling, rat. I'd like nothing better than to gut you. But I've got plans for you, so listen good.
Wide-eyed with surprise, Sagatar lay staring upward at Rascanza as the devious fox relayed his information to her. It was high noon of the following day. Ublaz sat atop the timber piled at the rear of his palace, and below him, on the sun-baked ground, Sagatar crouched, not daring to raise her eyes as she related the fox's message.
Mightiness, the fox is called Rascanza. He said to tell you that it was he who slew Baranka, and now he alone rules the rebel crews. Even now he is on his way here and the Bloodkeel. He wants to meet you tomorrow morning on the heights above the North Inlet. You may bring armed guards with you. He says he wants to talk peace.
The Emperor whittled pensively at a sliver of wood with his silver dagger.
Rascanza, eh? He said. This fox sounds like one I could do business with. I think we'll take him up on his offer.
Pick 50 of your best trident rats, and a score of monitors to accompany me. Oh, and Sagittar, you know what will happen should you ever fail me again. Avoiding the mad eyes, Sagittar stood trembling, head bowed. Mightiness, I will never fail you again. Ublas smiled thinly, his voice like oil flowing over ice. I would hate to be in your skin if you did. 17. Logalog inspected Grath's longboat.
You've got a couple of boards cracked there, matey, he announced. I'll get some of my shrews to turn her over, and we'll patch her up again.
The longboat had shipped water, and now she was over a quarter full. Six Gwasom shrews heaved and huffed as they tried to turn the vessel over in the shingled cove. Grath waved them aside. Save your strength, mates. I can do that. She dismantled the mast and sail, placing them safe. Then, digging her powerful paws under the shingle, she found a hold and lifted. In one move, she turned the longboat upside down in a rush of water. The shrew named Dabby wrinkled his nose in admiration. Now that's what I calls a strong beast. Pine resin was melted over an open fire. Skillfully, the Gwasom applied it, alternating layers with tough vegetable fibers, until a proper repair was effected on the cracked boat ribs. Other shrews had sewn and patched the torn sail, double-strengthening it on all four corners. Finally, Grath set the longboat upright and said, Logalog, I thank you and your Gwasom for the help and kindness you've shown me. True friendship can't be properly expressed by just words, but, matey, I'll never forget you. The shrew chieftain kicked awkwardly at the pebbled shingle. Oh, 'twas nothing, mate. What use are friends if and they can't help one another? You be on your way now, afore this tide ebbs. Trimp, Dimple, load those victuals aboard for our mate. Two bags of provisions and a couple of canteens filled with drink were stowed under the stern seat. Aided by a gang of shrews, Grath pushed the longboat into the shallows and jumped aboard. Looking back at her newfound friends on the shore, she sniffed and rubbed a paw across her eyes as she began setting the sail to catch the fine spring breeze. Logalog waded out and shook the lone otter's paw firmly.
Ahoy, what's all this? No time for weeping now, missy. The tide'll ebb away. Go on. Off you go, Grath, and may good luck and fair winds follow you, matey.
Heading out to catch the south current, Grath leaned over the stern, waving to the Gwasom as they sang her on her way from the shore. Deep, gruff, shrew voices rang out across the waves into the bright sunny morn. Hey-la-ho, hey-la-ho, our hearts go with you where you go. Hey-la-hey, hey-la-hey, maybe we'll meet again some day. Like a feather on the breeze, blown to wander restlessly out upon the open seas, travel speedily and free. But as the earth turns and our fire burns, and the moss grows on the lee, when long day ends, think of old friends in whatever place you be. Hey-la-ho, hey-la-ho, fortune follow you where'er you go. Hey-la-hey, hey-la-hey, may sunlight warm your back upon the way. Late afternoon sun cast lengthening shadows over Mossflower. A fire burned in a sheltered glade, and Lask Frildur sat warming his claws, watching his 10 monitors prowling restlessly around the 2 pitiful figures bound to the trunk of an elm, long tongue snaking out, cold predatory eyes fixed on both mouse and bank vole. The lizard circled close. Abbot Durrell felt a scaly claw caress his footpaw. Closing his eyes tight, he shuddered. Viola, rigid with terror, huddled as close to Father Abbot as her bonds would allow. Durrell spoke reassuringly to her. Don't be frightened, little one. Had they been going to harm us, they would have done so long before now. We'll face them together and show them that Redwallers are brave creatures. One of the monitors brought his face close to Viola. She smelled the lizard's rancid breath as he bared sharp teeth and hissed, and she shrieked in fear. The monitor general far outstripped his lizards in size and strength. He bounded over and dealt the offending monitor a savage blow with his tail that sent the reptile crashing into a nearby bush. Then, turning to the others, Lask Frildur stood to his full height and snarled menacingly.
"Eat birds. Eat fishes. I slay any who go near these two."
Abbot Durrell addressed Lask in a reasonable and friendly tone. "Who are you, sir? Why have you bound us up like villains? We are creatures of peace." The Monitor General rounded on him contemptuously.
"Keep your stupid mouth closed, Mouse."
Viola plucked up her courage.
"Don't you dare talk to him like that,"
she shouted shrilly at Lask.
"He is Abbot Durrell, the father abbot of all Redwall Abbey."
A slow smile lit up the Monitor General's cold features.
"Good, good. This is very useful to me."
Durrell leaned back against the tree, sighing. "I wish you had not told him that, Viola. It has put both us and Redwall in a very dangerous position." The Vole Maid wept bitterly at the realization of what she had done. Durrell was immediately sorry he had chided her.
"Hush now, little one. Here, turn your head and wipe your eyes on my sleeve. It wasn't your fault, really. You are young and know nothing of situations like this. Hush now, don't cry."
A short time later, Romska strode into the glade at the head of her crew. She pointed to the prisoners.
"Aye, aye, what have we got here?"
Lask ignored the question. He spoke without turning from his fire.
"You have been gone long, Corsair. Why is this?"
Squatting by the flames, Romska speared an apple on her sword and began roasting it.
"I've got news for you, matey. Greylunk's long dead. I found his bones, me and my crew, over in a pile of rocks east of here." "What else did you find, Romska?"
"Nothing. Not a single thing. No sign of any pearls. Just old Greylunk's bones and the rags he wore."
"Did you talk with the creatures at Redwall Abbey?"
"Of course I did. That's how I knew where to find what was left of Greylunk. But mark my words, Lask, those beasts at Redwall ain't soft. They can fight, I know.
If the pearls are anywheres, you can lay a belaying pin to a bobbin. They're inside of that red-walled abbey somewheres. So, matey, you're in charge of shore operations. What are you going to do about it?"
The Monitor General did not attempt to hide a triumphant smirk.
"I have two captives. The old Mouse is Father Abbot of Redwall."
Romska nibbled at the steaming apple.
"Well, ain't you the lucky lizard? But watch your step, Lask. If those Redwallers find out you've got their abbot, they'll come searching for him in force and tear these woodlands apart. I tell you true, they've got tough, full-growed otters and beasts who ain't scared of battle."
Conva reckoned he saw a great badger roaming the wall tops last time we was here. "You might find you've bitten off more than you can chew, taking an abbot as hostage." Lask Frildur stood up decisively.
"I serve my Emperor Ublaz. I will do what I must. We must divide our forces, half to take the prisoners back to Waveworm, the other half to remain here under my command."
"Aye, that's good thinking, matey," Romska agreed, only too glad to be away from the hated Monitor General. "I'll take the hostages and my crew back to the ship." Lask gripped Romska's paw so tight that she winced. The Corsair managed to pull herself from the lizard's grip and stood fuming, paw on sword.
"All right, so be it. You don't trust me, and I don't trust you. Permission to go, your eye mightiness. Or will there be anything else, whilst I'm here to do your bidden?"
Smiling thinly, Lask produced a slim bone whistle and blew it.
"Oh, yes. I had visitors while you were gone. They will accompany you back to your vessel, just to keep an eye on things."
Grawl, the great black-backed gull, and his remaining two companions
looking much the worse for wear, came padding through the trees. As soon as Hogwife Teasel had told Martin about the Corsair Ferret and her questions about Greylunk and the pearls, he joined Skipper and his otters on the wall top, a look of concern clouding his face. Skipper seemed unconcerned, however. "Oh, it was a Corsair, no doubt of that, and I wager there's others waiting orders in the woodlands. But what's a crew of sea scum and vermin to us, Martin? We'll teach 'em a lesson they'll never forget, if and they comes too close to Redwall." Leaning over the parapet, Martin peered into the silent woodlands. "I wish it were that easy, Skip. But Tansy told me that the abbot is out there with young Viola. They should have been back by now." Dismay showed on Skipper's tough face. "What do you suggest we do, Martin?" "We'd best get the elders together and hold a quick council of war." Tansy and Rollo caught up with Martin as he crossed the lawn with Alma, the Badger Mother, and Formol. "Martin, what can we do to help?" The Warrior Mouse paused a moment before he entered the gatehouse where the other elders were waiting. "Keep on with the search for the other 5 pearls, you two. I've a feeling we may need them." Tansy pulled Rollo toward the wall steps. "Let's sit out here. It's a nice afternoon. Maybe we'll think better out in the fresh air." Rollo read out the rhyme from the waxy paper for the 4th time. Like the first of Fermal's poems, it seemed to make little sense. "I shed my 2nd tear into the cup of cheer. But look not into any cup, the answer's written here. My 1st is in blood, and also in battle. My 2nd in acorn, oak, and apple. My 3rd and 4th are both the same, in the center of sorrow and twice in refrain. My 5th starts eternity, ending here. My 1st is the 1st of last. Oh dear, if I told you the answer, then you would know 'twas made in the winter of deepest snow." Tansy drummed her paws in frustration on the steps. "Ooh, that Firmold. If she were still alive, I'd give her a piece of my mind. This rhyme's twice as tricky as the last one." They sat in silence, racking their brains, until the abbey bells tolled 4 times. Rollo had started to doze, but the bells woke him, and he said, "Come on, Tansy, let's go for tea." It was such a nice afternoon that Brother Dormal and Teasel had arranged tea in the orchard. Rollo and Tansy took scones, crystallized fruits, cream and steaming rosehip tea, and sat with Picnum the mouse maid and Cracklin the squirrel maid beneath the spreading boughs of an old gnarled apple tree. No sooner had Tansy sat down than Arvin's face appeared upside down in front of her. He wrinkled his nose and stuck out his tongue. "Pansy, Tansy, toodle-doo, boo!" The little squirrel was hanging by his tail from a bough. Tansy unhooked him and lifted him down. "You little maggot. You'll fall on your head one day." Arvin helped himself to a pawful of cream and ran off, giggling at the clever trick he had played. Picnum looked over Rollo's shoulder at the waxy paper. "What's that, Mr. Rollo? The words of a song?" The recorder threw up his paws in despair. "I wish it were, miss. It's a riddle."
"Ooh, a riddle. Lovely."
Picnum and Cracklin chorused in a single voice. Rollo looked at them over his spectacle tops.
"You mean that you like riddles? Are you any good solving them?"
The 2 friends immediately broke out into,
"If string cannot sing, then answer this riddle. What sings as sweet as the strings of a fiddle?
The fiddle string sings, but it never can throw an arrow so far as the string of a bow. But a bow plays a fiddle, and I'll marry thee, if you give a bright bow of ribbon to me."
They curtsied prettily, as Rollo applauded, saying,
"Well sung, missus. You can help us solve our riddle."
Picnum and Cracklin read Fermal's poem twice, then began tittering and winking at each other. Tansy looked from one to the other.
"You've solved it, haven't you?" she demanded.
They began teasing.
"Well, yes, but then again, no. We've solved it,
but not all the rhyme. But we know what the main part means. Oh, yes, it's a 6-letter word. Rollo could restrain himself no longer.
Well, in the name of seasons and summers, tell us.
Picknam and Cracklin were real teasers. They went off into gales of tittering and giggling until they were unable to talk. Tansy placed a restraining paw on the irate recorder. Leave this to me, Rollo. Scooping up 2 large globs of cream, she faced the laughing duo. If you don't tell me by the time I count 3, stand by for a creamy face wash. 1, 2... They both yelled out, "It's a barrel! It's a barrel!" Still holding the pawfuls of cream, Tansy commanded them, "Right. Show us how you arrived at the answer." Picknam and Cracklin talked like a double act, one after the other. "Well, we don't know what the first 2 lines mean. All that stuff about cup of cheer and shed a tear. But that line, my first is in blood and also in battle. Only 2 letters appear twice in both words, the B and the L."
"Yes, and the next line's easy. Acorn, oak, and apple have only 1 letter in common, the A. Now, look at these lines. My 3rd and 4th are both the same, in the center of sorrow and twice in refrain. The middle of the word sorrow contains the letter R twice, and R crops up twice in the word refrain, so it's R and R." "Correct. Now the next line. My 5th starts eternity, ending here." "Simple. What starts the word eternity and ends the word here?" "The same letter, an E." "The final one isn't too difficult either. My last is the first of last." "Huh. The first letter of the word last is an L. So we've got a B or an L, then an A, 2 R's, an E and an L. And it's certainly not Larrel, so it's got to be Barrel." Picknam jumped up and down, clapping her paws, squeaking.
"Oh, this is fun. Can we help you some more?"
Tansy was musing over the word and gazing at the waxy paper.
"What? Yes, of course you can help. Barrel. Where in Redwall would we find a barrel?"
Rollo put his food to one side.
"In the wine cellar?"
Picknam and Cracklin were off, running ahead of Tansy and Rollo.
"Last one to the wine cellar is a jumpy toad."
Rollo trailed on behind Tansy. "Carry on, young missus, with your fleet young paws. I'll just take my time like any old jumpy toad." 18. The Stump family had been in charge of Redwall's wine cellars for many seasons. Friar Higgle Stump's brother, Furlough, was a strong, fat hedgehog, conscientious and tidy in all things pertaining to his beloved cellars. He sat the 3 maids and Rollo down on a bench and fetched them a drink.
"This'll cool you down, fresh-brewed dandelion and burdock cordial," Furlough said as he poured out 4 beakers from a big jug.
It was cool, sweet, and dark, with a creamy foam head, and they drank gratefully. Then the cellar-keeper dug his paws into his wide apron pocket, saying,
"Now, young'uns, and you, Rollo, sir, what can I do for you?"
The recorder wiped a foamy mustache from his mouth.
"I know this sounds silly, Furlough, but we're looking for a barrel." "Well, sir, I've got lots of barrels down here. Which one would you like?"
Tansy spread the waxy paper flat on the bench.
"Trouble is, sir, we don't know. Maybe if you read this, it may help."
Furlough Stump was a slow reader. He borrowed Rollo's spectacles and scanned the rhyme for what seemed an age. Then he scratched his huge spiky head in bewilderment.
"Deary me, I can't understand none of that, missy. Here, you have a look round my cellars whilst I think about it."
Rollo took them on a tour. He had worked in the wine cellars on many an occasion when he was younger and had a fair knowledge of things.
"What a lot of barrels, Mr. Rollo."
"They're not all barrels, Miss Cracklin. Those great giant ones standing in the corner, they're called tuns. Beetroot wine is kept in them. Barrels are these smaller ones, mainly for ale. Then there's the Kilderkin, a bit smaller for cordials and such, and smaller again, half the size, is the firkin, usually for wines. Any small quantities of strong wine are kept in these little casks. Tansy waved her paw around, indicating the cellar stocks. So we can rule out most of these and just pay attention to the barrels? Is that right, Rollo? The old recorder shrugged. Who knows, maybe Firmald knew little of cellars, and they all looked like barrels to her. Where are we then? Furlough approached them, still scratching his head and looking very unsure of himself. Beg pardon, Rollo, sir, but I've been thinking about the poem as was written down on that paper. There's something a-botherin' my head. Those words at the end of the rhyme, the winter of the deepest snow. I remember when I was but a dibbin, my father told me something about a cellar-keeper named Ambrose Spike, long afore my time, though what it was he told me I can't recall. Rollo halted him with an upheld paw. Ambrose Spike, I remember him from when I was a dibbin. Picknum, you're the fastest runner. Nip across to the gatehouse and ask Wolger to dig out the volumes of a recorder named Tim Churchmouse. Cracklin, go with her. There may be more than one volume to carry. Bring them straight back here to me. Quick as you like, now. The two young ones sped off out of the cellars, shouting, Last one to the gatehouse is a frumpy frog. As it turned out, neither of the young maids was a frumpy frog. They matched each other for speed all the way to the gatehouse and back to the wine cellar, arriving breathless and burdened down with two volumes apiece. Furlough poured out more dandelion and burdock cordial for everyone. With tiny spectacles balanced on his nose end, Rollo poured through page after yellowed page, muttering to himself, Spring of the Lesser Periwinkle? Later than that. Autumn of the Late Marjoram? Later, I think. Summer of the Rose Bay Willow Herb. I've gone too far. It was the winter before that. Yes, here it is. Winter of the Deepest Snow. Got it. The three young maids leaned over Rollo's shoulder eagerly. What does it say, sir? Tell us. Rollo took a deep draught of cordial before reading. Ambrose Spike was lucky. He harvested all the rhubarb he had been growing alongside the west wall before the snows started. The snow is now so deep they have named this season the winter of the deepest snow. The weather outside is harsh and gloomy, but Redwallers are merry and snug within our abbey. I helped Ambrose in the cellars today. He is squeezing the rhubarb with great stone slabs and ale barrels as weights. The juice we mixed with clear honey and poured into a firkin. It is a beautiful pink color. Ambrose Spike would not allow me to touch it. He says it will not be properly ready for at least two seasons. But when it is ready, Ambrose is of the opinion it will be unequaled for taste. I left him to go back to my recording today. Ambrose was fitting the lid tight onto the firkin with soft willow withes. He had a brush and vegetable dye to paint the name on the firkin. I like the name he has chosen for this wine. The Cup of Cheer. Tansy repeated the first line of the rhyme aloud. I shed my second tear into the cup of cheer. Rollo slammed the volume shut, sending up a small dust cloud. Of course, a pink pearl and pink wine. There were a lot of firkins, each one identical to the next. They stood on end, too high. Furlough bade Tansy and her friends stand aside as he lifted each one down for inspection. They could not help smiling at the fashion in which hedgehog cellar-keepers wrote the names on different firkins, though they did not laugh aloud for fear of offending Furlough's stump. The powerful hedgehog lifted down one firkin after another for their inspection, and Rollo translated the simple spelling. Person up, cordial. Ahem. That'll be parsnip cordial. Pennyclud win, that'll be pennycloud wine. What's this one? Rabzeri viggin. Furlough chuckled. That's raspberry vinegar, sir. Us cellarogs ain't the best of scholars, but we know our own marks when we sees 'em. Tansy and Cracklin dusted off the bottom of a firkin, which Furlough had laid on its side. Picknam read out the faint green lettering. Ambrose Picks, Famous Copacheer. Tansy said the last word several times before it dawned on her.
Copacheer? Copacheer? Cup-a-cheer? Cup-o-cheer? Cup of cheer?
Rollo stroked the aged wood reverently. This is the one, made long ages ago in the winter of the deepest snow. Ambrose Spike's famous cup of cheer. It took quite a while for the cellar keeper to tap the bung. With his coopering hammer, he knocked a sharp spigot through the center of the firkin bung without losing a drop of its contents. Then, with a mighty heave, Furlough lifted the firkin onto a table and began running the liquid off into an empty barrel. They watched the pink rhubarb wine splashing out on the shining stream. Rollo caught some in a beaker and tasted it.
Delicious, but very strong. Perhaps Sister Cicely could make use of it in the sick bay for cold and chills.
Tansy could not resist adding, instead of warm nettle broth. When the firkin was empty, Furlough removed both tap and bung and began shaking it. Something clattered around inside. Picknam had the smallest paw. She reached inside and felt around.
Move it a touch this way, please, Mr. Furlough. A bit more.
Ah, got it. It was a tiny stone beaker, of the type used for medicine doses. Its top had been sealed over with beeswax. Furlough cut the wax away with a small quill dagger, and out fell an exquisite pink pearl.
My, my, that un's a fair beauty of a treasure, the cellar keeper remarked admiringly.
Ain't never seen anything as handsome in all me born days. Tansy, however, was far more interested in the thin fold of paper lining the bottom of the beaker. She picked it out and unfolded it. Alma looked around the worried faces inside the gatehouse and spread her paws placatingly.
Please, friends, let's not do anything hasty. There's still time for the abbot to return yet. I've often known him to stay out far later than this.
But not when there are corsairs and vermin abroad in Mossflower, said Martin. The badger mother turned her gaze on him.
What do you suggest we do? She asked.
The warrior mouse stared out of the window at the evening sky.
I think the best thing is to wait until dark. If Viola and the abbot are not back by then, something is surely amiss. I can lead a party out into the woodlands by night. We know the woods better than strangers do, and they will not be expecting us.
Skipper seconded Martin's proposal.
You're right, matey. I'll go along with you.
Hark, what's that? Wolger the gatekeeper knew immediately.
Some beast pounded on the main gate outside.
It ain't the abbot, though. Enoch's proper, like a gentle beast. Always three taps. I'd advise you go atop of the wall to see what beast is making that sort of din. Martin, Alma, and Skipper raced out of the gatehouse and up the wall stairs. They stood on the main threshold over the gate, staring down at a band of creatures, the leader of whom seemed to make the rural twilight sinister and unclean with its presence. Even Tough Skipper was taken aback.
"Season's a slaughter," he whispered to Martin. "Am I having a bad dream, or is that thing real?"
Surrounded by half a crew of corsairs and sea rats, the Monitor General stood head and shoulders over his remaining five lizards. Lask Frildor made a horrific and impressive sight. His flat reptilian eyes watched the Redwallers as he pointed a monstrous scaled claw and rasped officially,
"Open your gates! I have words to say to you!"
The warrior mouse showed no fear. His voice rang out like steel striking an anvil.
"I command these gates, not you. Say who you are and what you want, but don't try giving orders to me."
The huge monitor puffed out his throat balefully.
"I am Lask Vrildor, Monitor General to the mighty Emperor Ublaz. I come here to collect Zig's burls, called the Deers of All Oceans.
They were stolen from my master. You will return them.
Alma leaned towards Martin, her voice low. I don't like this. That reptile wouldn't turn up here demanding anything if he didn't have something up his sleeve. Skipper's lips barely moved as he muttered,
She's right, matey. You'll have to see if you can bluff him.
Martin kept his face grim and resolute as he murmured to his friend, I certainly will have to bluff my way along. We don't have 6 pearls, and it could be a long while until we do. Let's see if I can find out what's making this lizard so confident.
Lask's tongue was beginning to flicker impatiently. I am waiting, Mouse.
Martin leaned carelessly against the battlements.
Supposing we did have these 6 pearls to give you, what would we receive in return for them? The lives of your abbot, Mouse, and a bank bowl.
Martin felt his heart sink, but he kept up a nonchalant attitude.
You lie, lizard. How do I know you're holding them?
At a signal from the Monitor General, one of the lizards hurled up a small bundle weighted with a stone. It clattered on the threshold. Alma seized it and tore away the vine-wrapped rags. Martin felt his worst fears confirmed as he saw Skipper pick up 2 pairs of red-walled sandals, one pair slightly larger than the other. It was hard for the warrior Mouse to keep his voice calm as he said,
These are just 2 pairs of sandals. They could belong to any beast.
For the first time, Lask Frildur smiled, showing yellowed rows of evil-looking teeth.
The abbot Mouse is called Durl. Viola is the maid's name. You want more proof? Here.
Lask's claw shot out as he hurled something up. Alma swallowed hard. She picked up the delicate object. Both finely polished crystal lenses smashed.
Father Abbott's glasses. Look, Martin.
Blood rose in the warrior mouse's eyes. Raging and roaring, he tried to tug free of Skipper and Alma, straining to climb over the battlements at his foe.
Touch one hair of their heads, and I will slay you, scale scum. You and all your rabble, I will send you to Hellgates.
Lask had never seen such ferocity from any creature. He realized that Romska's warning had not been an idle one. These Redwallers did indeed have warrior blood in their veins. Steadying himself, he called back to the raging beast on the walltop.
Your friends are unharmed, but they are far from here on a vessel anchored out on the great waters. You cannot rescue them. Bring me the pearls, and I will release the captives, do you?
Having delivered his ultimatum, Lask marched off quickly with his followers and dodged smartly into the cover of Mossflower Wood. Alma held Martin tight. He was still struggling, tears of helpless rage flowing openly down his cheeks, and she had to exert all her strength to hold him.
Skipper, let's get him back down into the gatehouse, she said. We need to think this out calmly. Grab his footpaws. He has the power and wildness of a badger lord. I've never seen Martin like this.
Unaware of what had taken place on the walltop, Tansy sat with Rollo, Picknam, and Cracklin in the cellars, puzzling over Firmald the Ancient's 3rd and what seemed to them most baffling rhyme. Tansy read it aloud for the umpteenth time.
My sad 3rd tear is shed for one who now lies dead. A friendly foe it was to me, a cunning old adversary. Now heed the clues and read my rhyme. Patience pays but once this time. Inside the outer walls I lie. Without me, you would surely die. I am not earth, nor am I stone. No shape at all to call my own. Not bird or beast or flower or tree, yet captives live within me free.
Rollo removed his glass and rubbed his eyes, sighing wearily. Is there any of that dandelion and burdock cordial left?
Pour me some, please, Cracklin. This is a real poser, and no mistake.
The squirrel maid offered a suggestion as she poured the drink.
I wonder if Firmald was writing about the dead creature Greylung.
See, the first line says, "My sad third tear is shed for one who now lies dead." What do you think, Tansy?
The Hogmaid studied the slim paper scrap in front of her.
No, it couldn't be. Greylunk's remains are outside in Mossflower, and this line states clearly, "Inside the outer walls I lie."
The Mousemaid agreed.
Correct. What we're looking for lies within the walls of our abbey. It's not much of a clue, but I think it means something not actually inside this main building.
Cracklin thought about it, then seconded her friend's view.
Aye. When we talk of things in the grounds, we always say inside the abbey walls,
not within the abbey, but between the building and the outer wall. Rolla was tired, but the logic suddenly dawned upon him.
Oh, I see. You mean outside. The orchard, the lawns, and so on.
Right. Who do we know who lies buried out there? Hurlow Stump was restacking the firkins back in place, listening to the conversation. Leaving his work, he ambled over, wiping slowly at his strong paws with a damp cloth.
Beg pardon, but don't mind me saying, I think you're wrong looking for a he or a she. The poem says it were an it, not he nor she. A friendly foe it was to me, the line says. I'm probably wrong, though, but I just thought I'd mention it.
Tansy shook Furlow's paw heartily.
Well done, Mr. Furlow. That was cleverly thought out. Sometimes we can get too smart for our own good and miss the clue, and that's when we need good common sense like yours, sir. Come on, let's take a look around outside. There's still time before dark.
The friends had barely ventured outdoors into the gathering dusk when Alma came hurrying towards them, calling,
Have you seen Martin or Skipper recently? Are they inside?
Tansy sensed something was wrong by the worried look on the badger's homely face.
No, we haven't seen them, Alma. What's happened?
Ushering them back inside, the badger mother glanced about.
Come, help me search for Martin and Skipper. I'll tell you as we go.
Book 2. Westward the Warriors. 19. Pale white as watery milk, a spring moon cast its light over the still trees of Mossflower, patching light and deep shadows throughout the silent woodlands. Without the need of lanterns, Martin the Warrior Mouse strode abreast with the Skipper of Otters, Clecky the Mountain Hare, and his companion Girl, the Barn Owl. Martin had sheathed the sword of his legendary namesake across his back. Skipper carried slings, stones, and a light javelin, whilst Clecky had found a hare longbow and quiver of arrows in Redwall's armory. Geral had his formidable talons and fierce curved beak, weapons enough for any owl. Telling only Alma of their plans, the four friends had slipped away from the abbey, making a pact that they would only return in the company of Abbot Durrell and Viola Bankbull. Skipper and Martin were both experienced trackers. A broken twig, a crushed leaf, or the slightest paw dent in the Mossflower loam was sufficient to tell them that they were right on the trail of Lask Frildur and the vermin crew. It was long after midnight when they spotted the glimmer of campfire twixt the tree trunks. Martin waited with Clecky and Skipper while Geral flew to investigate, gliding like an elusive moonbeam through the high foliage. They had not long to bide before Geral returned. Fluttering down to the low boughs of an alder, the owl blinked and ruffled his breast feathers briskly.
Ah, 'tis them, all right, sir. Bold as brass and cheeky as chaffinches, squatting on their hunkers and gnawing at poor dead birds. But the big lizard spoke truth, so he did. There's not a sign of the good old abbot, nor the little Volmaid.
He's hid them away on that ship he spoke of, the scurvy rascal.
Martin unsheathed his sword.
Skip, you go in from the left. Clecky, you and Geralt circle in from the right. I'll take the center. Wait for my call. Then it's straight in and give no quarter. But remember, we want to take the leader alive, so don't slay the big one called Lask. We need him to bargain for the abbot and Viola. Go now, and good luck be with you.
A single vermin sentry had been posted on the left side,
It was closest to the woodland edge, and Lass considered that the most likely place an attack would come from. Normally he would not have bothered with the sentry, but something in the maddened eyes of the warrior mouse had told him that this was no creature who would sit still and bargain whilst those under his protection were held hostage. The sentry was a burly stoat called Scarbod, veteran corsair of many fights and battles. Hiding behind an elm trunk, Scarbod watched Skipper creeping noiselessly forward. The stoat stood well hidden by the broad elm, as drawing a scimitar, he waited for the otter to pass him. Skipper heard the corsair's blade start whistling through the air. Only speed saved the otter chieftain's life. Throwing himself flat to the earth, he left the blade slashing night air. Then, rolling over, he thrust upward like lightning with his javelin.
Yeog!
Scarbod's last scream was cut short as he fell dead on top of his slayer. As Skipper threw him off, pandemonium broke out. Martin charged through the center like a thunderbolt.
Red Wall!
A sea rat, who was not fast enough, fell to Martin's blade. Lask Frildor immediately signaled his monitors to follow him. Leaping back out of the firelight, he hissed at the corsairs.
He is only one. Kill the mouse!
Suddenly, Martin was hemmed in by vermin swinging a variety of weapons. He cleaved a ferret immediately in front of him. A weasel behind him raised an axe, but before the vermin could strike, a feathered shaft took it through the nape of his neck, and the time-honored battle cry of hares and badgers rang through the glade.
Eulalia!
Klecky and Geralt stormed in, at the same time Skipper hit hard on the opposite flank of the melee. Four more fell before the corsairs broke and scattered in all directions. The fire had been scattered in the ambush. Klecky coughed and rubbed his eyes as he staggered about, shouting,
On with the buffs! Death before dinner! Stand and fight!
Skipper halted the hare, who had picked up a broad-bladed cutlass and was in danger of felling any beast who came near with it.
Whoa there, mate! Can't you see they've fled?
The otter said. As the smoke cleared, it became apparent that the four Redwallers were alone. Martin stepped out of the cloud of choking smoke, saying,
What happened to the lizards?
Geralt beat the air with his wings to clear it.
The blackguards never even stopped to fight, sir. They were away through the dark like a half-dozen old swallows flying south.
Skipper had picked up the trail on the far side of the camp.
They went this way, Martin. Come on.
Lask and his monitors had a good head start. They emerged from the woodlands onto the path, where most of the panic-sped remnants of the crew joined them. The monitor general found himself facing an angry sea rat brandishing a spear.
You rotten coward! Sliding away and leaving your shipmates in the lurch! You're a spineless, scale-faced...
Lask wasted no time. One great smash of his heavy tail left the sea rat lying with a broken neck. Scuttling across the path, Lask leapt into the ditch running along its west side.
We must get back to the vessel. Follow me, or stay and die like he did.
Wordlessly, they piled into the ditch and splashed along behind the monitor general, their flight made more desperate by the knowledge that the Redwallers would soon be on their heels. Skipper was lagging behind. Martin waited for him to catch up, and saw that he was hobbling slightly. "Skip, what's the matter, you old stream dog?" he asked. The otter grimaced and lifted his right footpaw.
"Oh, I'll be all right, mate. Stepped on some vermin's fallen sword back there. 'Tis only a scratch."
Klecky inspected the wound.
"If you call that a scratch, bucko, then I'd hate to see what you call a real wound. Geralt, Martin, scout about. See if you can come up with any herbs. Sit still, old chap. This shouldn't take long."
Martin returned with dock leaves, but Geralt had found some young sanicle, of which he was very proud.
"The old mother always said sanicle's just the plant for keeping wounds from getting infected. She said 'twas also a grand remedy for the owl whumps and spotty egg pimples, so she did."
Martin tore a strip from his tunic sleeve, and Klecky used it to bandage the dock and sanicle tightly to Skipper's footpaw.
"There you go.
You'll never see an otter totter with a bandage like that on his jolly old paw.
What, what?
And you won't have to worry about spotty egg wumps or owl pimples or whatever it was that Burble Beak's old mum was always going on about. So, that's you fixed up. The old scout, good as new. Clecky was right. Skipper could get along on the bandaged footpaw as if it had never been injured. Dawn was starting to streak the sky as the friends scoured the path for signs. It did not take Skipper long to discover Lask's plan.
Ha! Old Scaletail thinks he's throwing us off the scent by jumping in the ditch and sloshing through the water.
Just look here, Martin. Bruised nettles, broken reeds, mud sloshed everywhere. It's plainer than the nose on your face. They walked along the edge of the ditch, following the signs, as the sun rose on a bright spring day. 20. Breakfast at Redwall that morning was a subdued affair. Tansy hardly noticed little Arvin and the mole maid, Diggum, helping themselves slyly to the blackcurrant muffins on her platter. She looked up from a beaker of mint tea growing cold in front of her. Alma the Badger mother was rising from her seat. A gradual hush fell on the diners as Alma's paw went up.
"Friends, there is a lot of gossip and rumor abroad in our abbey since last night, so let me set matters straight. Our abbot and young Viola Bankvoll have gone missing. They are probably lost in Mossflower Wood somewhere. Martin has taken some companions and gone to search for them. I am sure that eventually they will all come home safely. Meanwhile, our life at Redwall must carry on as usual. Abbot Durrell would wish it so. Therefore, I ask you to carry on with your work as you always do. Look after the Dibbons. Do not wander outside the abbey gates. See to your chores, and above all, please do not indulge in gossip and scaremongering. That is all.
Diggum absently took a gulp of Arvin's penny cloud cordial. Worum bouty girt blizzard. Will he come back and eat us oop? Arvin considered this as he stole Diggum's nut bread.
No, blizzards only eat habits and voleses.
Tansy wiped cordial from Diggum's chin.
The word is lizard, not blizzard, and don't say such horrible things. What has Mother Alma just said about gossiping?
Arvin wrinkled his nose at the hogmaid as he climbed down from the dining bench.
She didn't say Dibbons not gossip. We be lickle and don't know no better. Come on, Diggum.
With their paws about each other's shoulders, the unstoppable pair ambled off, chanting at each other.
Gossip, 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 gossip.
Rollo joined Tansy, nodding in the Dibbons' direction.
What are those two up to?
Tansy shook her head, smiling fondly at the retreating Dibbons.
Oh, they're just gossiping. They're too little to know any better.
Rollo adjusted his glasses higher on his nose.
Let us gossip a bit about these pearls. Alma tells me we need all six of them to ransom Viola and the abbot from their captors.
Tansy got up and accompanied Rollo outside.
That's a lot easier said than done. This third rhyme has me well and truly stumped, Rollo. Did you dream up any solutions during the night?
I know I didn't.
Picknum and Cracklin were already outside, sitting on the ramparts over the gatehouse. Teasel the hogwife was with them, sipping at a large mug of dandelion tea.
Morning, Rollo. Morning, Tansy. My, what a nice day 'tis. I'm just cooling my old paws out here, and taking tea. Them kitchens get so steamy hot after breakfast.
Rollo and Tansy went up to the wall top and continued studying the rhyme with Picknum and Cracklin, whilst Teasel sipped tea and hummed to herself. Tansy passed the thin paper to Picknum.
Oh, here, you have it. I'm getting dizzy just looking at that rhyme and getting nowhere with it. My sad third tear is shed for one who now lies dead. A friendly foe it was to me, a cunning old adversary.
I can repeat it by heart now. Teasel, you knew Firmald the Ancient as well as any.
What friends did she have, to your knowledge?
The good hogwife scratched her head spikes.
Friends, you say?
I don't know as Firmold ever spoke of other beasts as friends, except in that wounded vermin Greylunk, and maybe old Grimjaw, and that'n she spoke of as friend and foe in the same breath.
Aye, Firmold, were a right old strangin.
Rollo looked up sharply from the rhyme.
Grimjaw? Who in the name of Autumn Apples was Grimjaw?
Teasel sipped at her tea, rocking back and forth.
Firmold often told me about Grimjaw, though goodness knows what she'd have done with the thing if ever she'd have caught it.
Rollo blinked impatiently over his glasses at the hogwife.
Really, ma'am, will you please stop talking in riddles and tell us what you know about this Grimjaw?
Teasel blew huffily on her tea to cool it.
Now don't you get all sharp with me, Mr. Recorder, or I shan't say another word. Politeness don't cost pear puddin', they say.
Tansy smiled winningly, stroking the ruffled hogwife's paw. There, I'm sure Rollo didn't mean to be sharp, Mrs. Stump. Please tell us about Grimjaw. It's very important that we know.
Teasel cast a fond glance at the young hogmaid. Well, all right, missy. Never mind that old grump. I'll tell you. Every time there was about to be a feast or celebration, Firmold brought out her rod and line to fish the abbey pond. She was forever trying to catch a big old grayling that had lived there for more seasons than most could remember. Firmold wanted that fish to grace the abbot's table, but she never did manage to catch it. She'd stop out there from dawn till dusk, empty-pawed and hungry. Later I'd serve her supper leftovers. Teasel, she'd say, that grayling is my best friend and my worst foe. The long hours I spent trying to catch that fish, she'd say. But he won't be caught, the old villain. He always escapes my line. That's what she'd say.
Suddenly everything became clear to Cracklin. She waved the paper, chanting,
Inside the outer walls I lie. Without me, you would surely die. I am not earth, nor am I stone, no shape at all to call my own, not bird or beast or flower or tree, yet captives live within me free. The answer is water. Without it, any beast would surely die. Water is not earth, stone, beast, bird, flower, or tree. It has no shape of its own. Fish swim freely in it, though they are really captives of whatever stretch of water they live in. Our water lies within the abbey walls. I can see it from here, the abbey pond.
Teasel watched the young ones scampering down the steps and speeding over the lawns with Rollo in their wake. She sipped her tea.
Deary me and lackaday, dashin' and rushin' about, where'll it all end? Ah, well, leastways now a body can supper dandelion tea in peace and quiet, before it's time to get lunch prepared.
The four searchers stood at the edge of Redwall's pond. It was a pretty spot. Rushes and sedge sprouted thick in the shallows of its far edge, and an old flat-bottomed punt lay moored at the east bank. At its southern end, the ground was light and sandy, running from a soft mossy hillock into the sun-warmed shallows. Deeper out, the water took on an emerald green hue, and myriad small flying insects dipped to cause ripples in the stillness. Gazing at the peaceful scene, Tansy raised a question which had been bothering her since she had first heard about the grayling.
How do we know old Grimjaw is dead?
Firmold never caught the fish, and we've only her word that he died. Maybe Grimjaw was just too old to rise to the bait. Perhaps he's still alive down there. It was a sobering thought. None of them fancied searching a dim pond where a big grayling might be lurking in the depths, or hiding among the reeds to defend its territory against intruders. Then Tansy came up with a quick solution.
"Hi, Glenner. Got a moment to spare down here?"
she called to the wall top. Glenner was a young female otter, one of Skipper's crew. She was still on wall top patrol, keeping an eye out for gulls or vermin. Glad to be relieved of the monotonous task, she bounded readily down, calling, Good morrow, mates. Anything I can do for you?
Flicking a pebble into the pond, Tansy watched the ripples spread.
Glinner, do you think there's a big old grayling in there? She asked.
The otter thumped her tail thoughtfully on the bank.
I don't know, could be.
Skipper always told us when we were young never to disturb big old fishes. They can be very dangerous and bad-tempered. There's an old otter poem we had to learn as young'uns. Frisk in the water if you wish, but stay clear of the big old fish, especially those with the fin like a sail. They're the rogues who'll take your tail. So stay in the shallows in bright sunlight, and you'll live to sleep round the fire at night. End of Side 3. To continue, turn the cassette over.